This is Collaborate, a Net Zero podcast brought to you by the ECITB. In this series, we will talk to experts at the forefront of the energy transition. We will cover a wide range of topics, from technologies that are key to unlocking industrial decarbonisation, to regulation and policy development, and perhaps most important of all, the skills needed to help industry deliver net zero. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to the first podcast in ECITB's series Collaborate, Transitioning to Net Zero. My name is Carol Sinclair and I'm a project manager for Net Zero at the ECITB. So firstly, thank you for downloading this podcast. We're aiming to promote knowledge sharing around net zero related activities and good practice within the engineering construction community and in the UK industrial clusters. This first podcast, our topic is decarbonising industry, net zero in the industrial clusters. So the industrial clusters, by definition, it's a concentration of related industries or several industrial sites that are grouped closely together within an area. The clusters are energy intensive industrial centres, so we'll see a wide range of companies or sites, maybe linked by production or a manufacturing process. Round about that, there'll be the network of supporting supply chain companies, specialist infrastructure, transportation and shipping, and other stakeholders. So in the UK, there are six large industrial clusters, with Grangemouth in Scotland, and then across England in Teesside, Humberside, Merseyside, Black Country in Southampton, and then in the south of Wales. So emissions across these industrial clusters might be considered hard to abate, particularly in view of the achieving the emission reduction targets and the timelines that have been set. And while that might be so, it is imperative for industry to decarbonise its operations. Industry contributes around 25% of UK greenhouse gas emissions, with more than two-thirds of these are coming from industrial clusters and their energy-intensive activities. So this makes the industrial clusters the epicentre of decarbonisation development. So this podcast seeks to highlight what net zero means to the industrial clusters in the UK in view of the government's aim to establish the world's first net zero carbon industrial cluster by 2040 and at least one low carbon cluster by 2030. So I'm delighted to be joined in conversation with Matt Browlhook, who's the Sector Director responsible for the energy business within Costain Natural Resources Division. Matt's an experienced energy professional. He's got over 18 years of experience in offshore and onshore hydrocarbon, renewable and major project arenas, with leadership of consulting, engineering and delivery teams across the UK and Europe. Matt's a fellow of the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, and he sits on the leadership board of Costain, as well as further education and STEM organisations. Matt's a passionate leader and an engineer who believes the societal demands for net zero lie within the gift of our engineering talent in the UK. He's a proud advocate of just energy transition approach and promoting diverse, inclusive and a curious approach to tackling the biggest challenge of our age in decarbonising the UK. So Matt, thank you so much for taking time out to speak with us today to help us to consider decarbonisation in the industrial clusters and what this means for the engineering construction industry and skills.
So I think probably a good place to start would be to explain what net zero means, as we hear a lot about that these days. So what is net zero decarbonisation and why is it so important?
So I think, thanks. I think we need to go back to essentially where we are. You know, climate change is a real scientific proven fact. And essentially over the past 200 years, since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, you know, we as a society and in the developed industrial world have been using fossil fuels to produce energy And industrial processes to create things, to improve our lives, and to give us what we need. The cost of that has been the emissions of greenhouse gases into the environment, which ultimately has led to the effect of global warming. And the Paris Agreement from a number of years ago now set out a plan that said if we can limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, then we can manage the worst effects of global warming. And so what net zero is really about is trying to come up with a methodology in a way of ensuring that we can limit our effect on the world, our effect on the environment, to match that Paris Agreement, Paris Accord requirement of 1.5 degrees. And so when we say net zero, what we mean by net zero 2050 is that by 2050, we will put as much greenhouse gas emissions into the environment as the environment absorbs, i.e. it's a balance. So if you think of it as a bath, when you open the bath taps, as much water is going in as is coming out of the plug hole. Essentially, so we're not trying to remove the emissions that I had before. We're simply trying to carry on with our standard of life, our energy requirements and needs as they are today and as they will develop over the next 30 years or so, but to do that in a balance and to make sure that our emissions don't exceed what the environment and carbon sinks and the soil and the forests and other areas can absorb, and the oceans, etc., back into the planet. And so what we have to do to achieve that is look at where our emissions come from and how can we either abate or manage those emissions, or ideally remove them altogether, to make sure that we are bringing ourselves back into that balance. And when we talk about UK net zero, that covers all of the emissions from the UK and the devolved governments. And there's some slight nuances about which devolved governments, how fast they will get there. But overall, what we have legally signed up to is to achieve that balance by 2050. And so when we talk about net zero economies, net zero climate, net zero emissions, what we're really talking about is getting ourselves to the point of balance where we are emitting no more than we are absorbing.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Matt. I think that's a fantastic sort of scene setter and just laying out exactly what that means for us, the history of it. And I like that analogy with the bath. That really just sort of visualises and brings that to life for us. Thank you. So how can industry and organisations create a net zero strategy to offset and reduce their emissions?
So this is the big grappling fact of today's society. You know, we've seen a massive shift over the last, say, 5 years of many private organisations very quickly moving to a position of they talk about net zero roadmap 2035 or 2040 or 2050. And what they're talking about there is how do they get their own behaviours, their own operations to a net zero position. And that could be offsetting, as in finding ways of capturing the equivalent greenhouse gas emissions from their day-to-day activities, or reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that are created by their activity. And the kind of accepted general parlance for that is something called scope emissions. And they are handily put into three areas, scope 1, 2, and 3. And the definition of those is that essentially your scope one emissions are your direct emissions from sources that are owned or controlled by, in this case, let's say, the company. Scope two emissions are the indirect emissions from purchased energy, such as electricity or heat or cooling or steam. And then scope three emissions, as the tricky one, are all other emissions associated with the company's activities, i.e. what is that product they've created, what is their emissions associated with that that the end user will create, et cetera, et cetera. And so in terms of getting ourselves to where can we get to a net zero strategy, the first part of that, the key element here, is to understand what are your emissions, what are your directly controlled emissions associated with your activity, and what are your bought-in emissions, what are you purchasing? And then the much harder and unfortunately the larger part of the pie is that cross-sector, cross-user, cross-population, scope 3 emission piece. And so what we're seeing is a maturing of the model as these things become both more accepted, more understood, and more developed, where typically companies will say, we are going to take direct control of our scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, i.e. that of which we are directly in control of, and we're going to manage those and mitigate those such that by a given timeline, 2050 or before, we will be in a net zero position, i.e. we'll be in balance. The larger and much more challenging part of this is the scope 3 emissions and how we manage those. And there are the various views and positions being taken on how we do that. But I think in pragmatic and practical terms, you know, we have to accept the net zero challenge for what it is, which is essentially the biggest engineering challenge of our lives at this stage. And so we've got to take this in the way that we can manage it. And I think by managing our scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, we are making a direct and large benefit. And then what we want to see is, as we move through societally, as we change our behaviours and adapt to everyone achieving a net zero position in their personal lives, their corporate lives, and the work they do, that we will see some benefits that come along from that, i.e. a car manufacturer, the amount that car is driven is a scope 3 emission. Well, we are banking on there being a societal change where people will either buy less cars or drive them less, as well as have more fuel efficient approaches, etc. And so therefore we'll start to manage those scope 3 emissions. But from an organizational point of view, the levers that are within our control are those direct emissions and indirect emissions, so your scope 1 and scope 2. And that's the key focus area for most large organizations as it stands at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And yes, I think that's a great understanding and background that you've given, particularly, you know, if we've got listeners from new entrants, graduates, and from our SME community. And yeah, absolutely, that sort of manage and mitigate around scope 1 and 2 is more immediately in our hands, but yes, the scope 3 is the more challenging. So do you think industry can build a collaborative framework for life cycle assessment and optimization of industrial decarbonisation systems to help supply chain contractors to optimise greenhouse gas reductions?
So I think this is, yes, it's in our control. What we have to do is establish the facts very clearly. And I think, you know, we've seen a lot of government guidance, industry guidance, move us on this way. So you end up with, in a sort of crude way, an apples for apples comparison. What we don't want to do is end up with a model that is dominated by greenwashing, is a term that's often used, where you're not actually doing anything, you're just making a lot of noise and making it look like, you know, you've really reduced your emissions. So being really clear about, you know, what a ton of concrete is as a carbon emissions, and some of those will mean that we have to use proxy measures, i.e. we'll have to agree a greenhouse emissions for an equivalent unit of, say, a ton of steel, a ton of concrete, a ton of aggregate. And then that will allow us to use those proxies to talk at a level playing field about what our emissions are. And then we've really got to think about, well, how can we all play a part in this? And so this comes down to both contractual mechanisms of how we procure certain pieces of engineering or equipment or materials, and having an openness and a transparency right across the supply chain from the procurer or the industrial cluster owner of that particular contract right the way through the supply chain, so that we understand where those emissions are. And you know, when you think about that, you typically have, you know, very large organizations at the top of the tree, and then that will move through the supply chain down to, you may have, you know, very small SME type companies at the lower end of the supply chain, offering some really valuable services that are absolutely required to make these projects happen, but they don't have the necessary corporate overheads or the large structures where they can afford to have huge investment in understanding all the different parts of the emissions of their business. And so I think, yeah, we've got collectively as an industry, we have to support each other to ensure that no one gets left behind, and that we have a common way of speaking. And I think we're seeing that with the government requirements around Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions reporting coming into larger businesses. And I think the action of that and the activity around that will flow down through supply chain. But we have to accept that if we're asking someone for a piece of information that they have never provided before, we have to support them in being able to understand and have a level of rigor and accountability associated with those numbers. And I think the other thing, particularly when we talk about industrial clusters, that we have to bear in mind is that the goal of these projects is to remove, in general, because of the scale, a very large amount of greenhouse gas emissions per annum. And so that can become slightly blinding. And so what we've really got to think about is not only that goal, and that's what success looks like, this is what the project is about, is removing X tons of carbon per annum. But we've also got to think about how we get there. So how do we develop these projects progressively and in partnerships and successfully to both, you know, ultimately, first and foremost, be safe, be effective, but also how do we manage the impact that these projects have during their design, development and construction? And so thinking about that from the start, about trying to minimise material usage, and think about construction techniques, think about how people are moving about the projects, how we do power generation on site as we build these projects, etc., is really important, because, you know, we have to bear in mind that everything we do, every activity we undertake, has an associated emission. And so therefore, the more we can manage that, we're really sort of setting in that mindset right from the start. And I think we've seen it on some of the industrial clusters, you know, to date, is a really proactive approach to getting the key partners around the table, getting the supply chain around the table, and really reinforcing this point about, this is what the project is about, this is what we're trying to achieve, what different parts of different teams and organizations have to play in that, and how we can bring that together to be a really, you know, successful thing. And I think, you know, best practice guidance sharing, seeing successes from project A and sharing it with project B, and just being really an open and transparent, just the same way we have been successfully done across industries with health and safety development over the last 50 years. We need to very rapidly absorb and replicate that open and honest culture in the decarbonisation world.
Excellent. So a lot to be getting into there, and interesting that you're already starting to see some proactive approaches coming through in the clusters. That's really promising to hear. So what do you see as the key challenges for industrial decarbonisation in the cluster regions? You know, taking into consideration UK infrastructure, you know, what needs to be done to decarbonize some of the most emission intensive industries?
Yeah, I think the first thing that we have to get away from is a blame game around, you know, the industrial communities and the industrial clusters have developed over, you know, in some cases over 100 years. And it is entirely normal, efficient and understandable that heavy industry processes pull together because you call on the same skill set from the local community to support you in doing it. You have typically an abundance of supply of raw materials, natural gas, power, water, whatever it is you need to allow those to happen. So actually we take a massive benefit in a decarbonisation strategy sense by having these heavy emitters pulled together. It's enormously helpful compared to a decoupled system where you've got bits of emitters largely geographically spread. So first thing we have to recognise is that actually the industrial clusters from an engineering standpoint are enormously useful. It's great that all of those emitters are close. The challenge we have here is a number of elements to this. So firstly, these are complex engineering challenges. You know, you typically have you're trying to engineer processes and systems with multiple parties, multiple emitters, multiple landowners, multiple health and safety boundaries and permit to work scenarios, as well as then taking that system and going, well, actually, some of this technology is unproven or unproven at an industrial scale. So there's a risk associated with that. And you're trying to connect this ecosystem together in order to get the benefit, to capture all that carbon or to produce hydrogen, whichever sort of different part of the schemes that you're looking at. And so that is a real challenge to be able to do it. And then you've got the overlay of the fact that, in essence, this is kind of a new industry in terms of we don't have a really large amount of financial modelling that talks about carbon capture and the transportation costs associated with the pipeline and how you generate a revenue stream to make these make sense. And we have to look at this pragmatically. You know, the government has put in place a series of funding mechanisms, but none of them are 100% funded. They are all seed funding to allow these projects to move forward. But ultimately, we are looking at private investors and private companies funding the development of these projects. And so they have to make some level of return. And I'm not making a comment here about whether it is a very high return or a very low return, but they have to, you know, cover the investment over a period of time. And so I think what we're seeing from the likes of BEIS and other government bodies at the moment is a real rapid rollout of the contractual and financial management of these bits of UK infrastructure, which is what they will end up being. And so, you know, that is a little bit unproven, it's a little bit untested, and the financial models haven't been wielded out in anger at the moment. And so there's a lot of development and learning to take place to allow this to really come to fruition and for these sites to be, you know, truly successful. I don't think anyone's advocating a scenario where they become, you know, enormous for-profit activities that mean that they kind of isolate out the original purpose, but they do have to make sense and work. And then of course that leads on to, you know, we are trying to both engineer, design and construct major pieces of UK infrastructure at the same time as we're seeing, you know, a government position which is to invest in UK infrastructure, which is great and is showing benefit at the moment. But it means that actually the skills, resources and trades that are required to make these projects successful are in demand. And so we've got to think about pragmatically, how do we build these? We are in a rush. You know, these projects need to be designed, get online and start delivering if we're going to hit our 2050 commitments. And so therefore, there is a kind of burning need to kind of move these projects forward at the same time as we're looking at projects, you know, a lot of water industry projects coming on stream over the next 5 years. We've got the high speed 2 rail network and a lot of road projects going on at the moment. So all of these things coming together are really creating a hotbed of UK infrastructure engineering at the moment, which is brilliant. But we also have to develop hand in hand with that is the future generations to ensure that the skills that we need and the experience we need are available to us, and we can make these projects successful in a reasonable time scale.
Yes, absolutely. And for ECITB particularly, our focus is on skills, and you know, there's as you mentioned, the complex engineering challenge, but also what you described as a very complex project management challenge as well, connecting all of these together, and also that challenge of making sure that we have that suitably skilled, qualified, competent workforce to be able to deliver on all of these sort of major infrastructure projects alongside the day-to-day business of other projects and industrial activities that are ongoing. So quite the challenge. So looking at the landscape that we're operating then on, you know, what's your view on how industrial decarbonisation landscape has changed over the last 6 to 12 months?
So I think it's been a fascinating part of the industry to be involved with. We've seen the clusters start to be awarded government-based contracts and via the track model, and we're seeing those projects start to gather momentum. And then we're also seeing things like the publication of the draft energy strategy and the just transition plan from the Scottish government. We've seen MP Chris Skidmore's review of the UK net zero 2050 strategy. And we are seeing some divergence there. You know, let's be fair, the Scottish government position is likely to be, or is certainly commented in their report to be, that things like hydrogen blending for domestic heat is unlikely to be something that develops much momentum. We're seeing a kind of requirement around tidal power coming out of that, which is an industry which is still growing. Lots of experience there, but to get to the kind of levels of generation required, you know, lots of work to happen. And then we see, you know, the Chris Skidmore's review, which really covers, you know, a slightly different view that says actually hydrogen for domestic heat is a key proposition. You know, the development and the financial benefit of developing these skills. So I think what we're really, the biggest thing we're starting to see is our devolved government start to really set out what their plans are. Then a UK government position which is adding more detail to the kind of strategic direction that we're going in, and you're seeing the rapid mobilization of private industry in attaining and achieving these goals, and so therefore we've seen a real acceleration, a lot of things happening, and of course, you know, there's a lot of things to debate, there's a lot of things to talk about, so there's a huge amount of emphasis around making some of these projects real and kind of gaining the quick wins to gain momentum, and starting to chew some of these really big, difficult projects to get us to where we need to be. So I think the landscape is going to be ever evolving for certainly the foreseeable period to come. I think what is going to drive consistently through that is that we've got in the industrial clusters, you know, a series of major projects. And so the development of those and the continual development of those, so they become successful, you know, real engineering projects in terms of construction sites and ultimately delivering the goals of those projects, that can't slow down. That will continue to be the driver as we move forward. But I think there is going to have to be at some point a bit of a reckoning between some of the divergences on views, and they may be regional, and that's okay. I think what private industry need is that stability to be able to invest in the long term plan, which is clearly, you know, the big driver here to get to 2050, as well as a really rapid increase in supply chain capability, particularly when some of the equipment that's required to kind of create things like hydrogen, the electrolyzer community, etc. We're really going to need to up and increase our production of these pieces of equipment, because there's a global demand, and the UK is sitting right on a global stage here. And so, you know, whilst these projects are critical to the UK, we're competing for some of that equipment and resources on a global playing field, and so therefore, you know, we've got to make sure we're moving quickly enough to take advantage of our pretty advanced position as it is today.
Mm-hmm. So yes, definitely. I mean, we're hearing an awful lot more about hydrogen and carbon capture, utilisation and storage projects, you know, as you say, here in the UK and globally. So do you see that sort of supply, is that the main challenge facing us in the use of hydrogen and CCUS and alternative low carbon fuels for the clusters in the UK?
Yeah, I think hydrogen is a really interesting case study on its own. You know, it's an abundant available element. The reality of it is that it's not overly naturally occurring, and so there's some fairly well proven methodologies to create hydrogen. I think the big issues for hydrogen are what often gets forgotten. You know, this is still a a safety related gas, just like natural gas is. This is something that requires skills and expertise to manage. It isn't risk free, and so therefore we've really got to be sensible about how we develop these projects and the safety protocols that we put in place and the engineering that we do. And we have the abundance of skills in the UK to be able to do that. And so I think we're in a reasonable position there. The truth of it is that at the moment that something like 98% plus of the UK's hydrogen generation today is actually based off fossil fuels, so it's mm-hmm. typically using natural gas. And what we need to see over the next 10 to 20 years is a shift, a complete 180 degree shift there, where we're using things like offshore wind generated power to power those electrolyzers to create the hydrogen, so that we are removing the need for fossil fuels to create that low carbon hydrogen. And so I think it will establish itself as a place for the future. But there's a short-term goal around using natural gas, and then there's a really important long-term goal around using green energy sources to create that hydrogen. CCUS, there are a number of projects there's a lot of projects in train across the world. There are a number of up and running projects, and they haven't universally been without their operational challenges. And so we've just got to keep working to get those projects up and running, capturing the carbon and getting it sequestered into the old oil and gas reservoirs. And so I think, there's a lot of learning still to be done there, and a lot of technical exploration to really, get that technology, get the approaches really moving at a pace where we need to get there. It's interesting that again, I referenced the reports earlier, but mm-hmm. things like the draft energy strategy from the Scottish Government is going down an approach of less focused on carbon capture, because they've gone down a route of, we won't do any projects that are fundamentally hydrocarbon based, like creating hydrogen from natural gas and capturing the carbon through that process. They'll wait and use things like offshore wind power. And then we've got a slightly different view with some of the UK Gov positions. So I think we'll see a challenge and a change there. The reality of it is that unless we change the primary part of the UK's electricity generation market and industrial processes, carbon capture has a significant part to play for us to be able to achieve net zero 2050. So I think the challenges that we see there are all around the technology development and rolling those out to real world sites, as quickly as quickly as we can, and to do so in a safety conscious way. These are high hazard industries, and I think in the UK we've got one of the leading high hazard industry capabilities. We've got an excellent safety record, and we absolutely must at all costs maintain that. And so that has to be the driving focus as we move through making these projects a reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And skills underpinning all of that, that safety and that working in that high hazard environment. You mentioned on the Mission Zero review for Net Zero, the report that was released in January by Chris Skidmore for the government. It was good to see there was an emphasis on skills within that, about building the skills needed for the transition, helping SMEs upskill, were strands of recommendations made for backing businesses transitioning to net zero, and seeing enabling skills for industrial decarbonisation in the supply chain. It was heartening to see that. So, in other reports, we're seeing an additional 350,000 workers required to progress energy transition projects in the industrial clusters. So what do you see are those sort of short, mid, long-term actions we need on skills to support the engineering construction industry?
Yeah, so I think a large part of the skills debate at the moment starts around the fact that a lot of the engineering skills that are required typically come from an oil and gas petrochemical background, because essentially the transferable skills in existence are already there. What we know is that actually attracting new graduates into the oil and gas industry at the moment is quite challenging. Societally, there's been a big shift away from that industry, and so there are challenges with recruiting enough engineers to feed that industry's requirements, as well as produce enough where there's then skilled people able to transfer their skills across. And so I think we've all got to do, all of us in the industry need to do a better job of explaining and identifying the real exciting hardcore engineering challenge that we have in the UK to hit net zero 2050. And that's going to take a range of solutions to be able to engineer these products and projects and get them to the point where they're really working. And it's going to take people from all sorts of different backgrounds and all sorts of different skill sets to get there. We've got a bright and proud track record of doing this in the UK, but it requires focus and attention, and it requires us to be able to articulate what these challenges are, why they're exciting, what skills we need to be brought to bear. And they go all the way from the conceptual engineering of solutions right through to building it, operating it, maintaining it, commissioning these bits of kit. So there's a vast array of capability that's going to be required to make these work, and we've also got to ensure that we're leaving a legacy of these skills behind in the geographical areas where we are driving these projects. And so it's a real important point about how we communicate things like the industrial clusters, communicate the needs, and then work with the education facilities that around both the local area and wider area, getting in, speaking to people, explaining where we're going, what's needed, so that people can get excited and see a future in their chosen field, and hopefully persuade some folks to take up a new field and try and get into it. And I think, you know, engineering in particular has a, you know, has an suffers from an assumed bias. So there, if you talk to a lot of people at, say, you know, school age, then there's an assumption of an engineer, you know, needs to be top tier maths, top tier physics, you know, various other things. And actually, when we look across the broad range of engineering capability, there's an awful lot of different strengths and skills that are needed, and we need to be much better at communicating those different skills so we can attract all the people that we need into the industry and move away from this, you know, I'm not on course for an A in maths, and therefore engineering is not a career for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's probably particularly the case in trying to attract a more diverse range of people coming into the industry as well. That approach that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be the AGC maths physics at school to be ready to come into the industry or into university or college.
Yeah. And I think that's an absolutely key point to make here, is that the answer for our challenge of UK net zero 2050 is not written down. We have to come up with elements of the answer of what's required. And there is huge amounts of study work that's gone into how does a team come up with the best idea? How do you solve the most complex challenges? And universally, they all show, if you have a diverse team coming at looking at problems, you come up with a better answer. And so the point about ensuring that we have diversity across the engineering pool is absolutely critical here, because we've got such a complex challenge. The more voices, the more skilled minds we can have looking at this, the better the answer that we're going to come up with.
Absolutely, yes. And I think, you're absolutely right. It is about that showcasing the exciting challenge that we have ahead of us, and trying to get a whole range of people from different backgrounds and different mindsets working towards finding the best solutions and the best ways forward.
It's super. Absolutely the most exciting time of my nearly 20-year career as it stands at the moment, and I think it's only going to get more exciting. This is, if you've got a curious mind and you like thinking of different solutions, there is no better time than right now to get into engineering. There's a beautiful and very rewarding career ahead of all of the engineering community, I believe, in over the next 30 years or so.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Matt. You know, I think that's a great point and a great message just to sort of conclude our discussion. So thank you very much for sharing your insights into decarbonising industry and net zero in the industrial clusters. That's been much appreciated. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thanks, Carol.
This was Collaborate, a net zero podcast by the ECITB. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss the next episode, and please visit our website at ecitb.org.uk. You can find out more information about our work to support industry in the transition to net zero by entering ECITB Skills for Net Zero into your search engine. See you again.